Good morning. May it please the court, I'm John Tice and I represent the defendant, appellant Gail Nettles in this case. We've raised three issues in our brief and I'd like to take those if we could in order and at the end if I have any additional time I'd like to discuss just briefly the issue of whether there's a harmless error analysis that's appropriate in this case. And talk a little bit about the facts, but we have not raised any issue as to the sufficiency of the evidence, but it may there may be some issue with regard to harmless error. The first is the motion that we made prior to trial. It was actually made twice. As the court knows from the record in this case, the case was originally, there was a motion to transfer it out of the district and to recuse the district court judges and to transfer it out of the district. And this court or another panel of the Seventh Circuit did...
We'll consider it all the Seventh Circuit since we are now, for the day, at least Seventh Circuit judges. So we'll... I think that's going to be the first question. That opinion by Judge Posner, in the tail end of his opinion, did he foreclose the venue argument by saying that... I mean, in effect, creating the law of the case?
The issue of whether it's the law of the case, while it has not been raised by the government, is certainly something that, the court could consider. But I think that the court, this court is the only court that's actually ruling on that specific issue as it was raised in the district court in the second motion to...
But you did raise this issue the first time around, including in the mandamus motion.
Yes, although the... I did not read Judge Posner's opinion to specifically rule on that issue because the judge ruled that it should go to a different different judge in the district. I think that the judge felt that that was a sufficient remedy at that time. If this court were to feel that there was nothing new that was raised and that that is the law of the case, that that would be binding. But it's our position that that is not the case and that this court has a right to review Judge Keenan's order where we requested that the case be transferred to another judge. We're not asking you to overrule anything that Judge Posner may have...
We'd be a little sensitive about that.
I would expect
especially
that,
as visitors.
Especially as guests in the Seventh Circuit. But I do not believe that that is something that this court would be doing if this court were to review that, because I do not read anything in that opinion by Judge Posner which specifically says that he is that court was ruling on this issue.
Are there any differences between the way the issue was presented the first time and the way it's now been presented to us?
There are no differences in the way it was presented. The issue
because
is
both
the same.
Are kind of as a matter of law.
Yes.
That's your point.
Right. But the focus of Judge Posner's opinion was the recusal issue, and I believe that that opinion did not say that solved all of the problems. All it said was that the recusal it was appropriate, and there was our position is that the issue was left open as to for the district court to rule on. For the new district court judge who was now reviewing this matter, since Judge Posner was saying that the original district court judge should not have, and again, with all respect to her, it was his position that it was an appearance issue and not an actual prejudice issue, but since she should not have been ruling on that, I think implicit in Judge Posner's opinion is that the new district court judge hearing the case should review any issues that were not resolved, that were still out there not resolved by his opinion. I believe you can make that determination. You can revisit the issue
of the transfer. Go ahead, Judge Gibbons.
I'd like to direct your attention to another aspect of the venue issue. Isn't this question just sort of over when we consider what actually happened during the voir dire, which was that only one juror had ever heard of this case, and that juror was not ultimately seated?
It is not, and here's our position with regard to that. The government focuses in large part, in their brief, and I expect they will today, on the issue of publicity, as that juror was asked about publicity.
Well, if we don't focus on publicity, then we're focusing on anxiety about being in the building that was the target of the plot. And if we focus on anxiety, there's not any of that expressed in any way. We couldn't find anything in the transcript of the voir dire, could we, that would give any credence to that?
I'd like to address that. First thing, you've used the word anxiety, which is I searched for a way of sort of summarizing our argument, and that's as good as any as to what. What I believe was implicit in these jurors being asked to make a decision about someone attempting to destroy by fire the very building they were sitting in. Anxiety, whatever that would be, yes, it is not publicity. We are focusing on this other issue, that it is impossible for them to be fair based
anxiety
on that.
Anxiety per se, sort of.
Well, in a sense, I would say that is perhaps the way we're characterizing it, that there is no other way. No, it's asking too much of them, is what we've said.
How would a juror in any other federal building, it seems to me that to the extent there's anxiety, that almost any juror in any federal facility in the country would think, gee, this defendant was plotting to blow up a federal building. It could be the building I'm in. You think that's materially different from a juror saying, gee, he was plotting to blow up the very building I'm in?
I do, and this is the difference. Every morning that juror sat, from the first day that they were called, before they had any idea even that they were going to sit on this jury, they walked into the building and sat in the building where there was testimony every day about it. There'd be descriptions of the defendant entering the building. At one point, he went inside the building. At another point, there was testimony that he was across the street. The government's position was he was conducting some sort of surveillance. I think there is a material difference between being in the building that they were listening to testimony about and seeing every day, and an abstract concept of another federal building, and that's the distinction I would make, and I do think it makes a difference. And also, if I could just go back to the issue you raised with regard to a juror expressing that concern or anxiety, I would think that's where I believe the Silverthorne case, which we've cited in our brief, is appropriate. Where Silverthorne, they said it's not the juror's call. They're not in a position to necessarily make that judgment. It's for the court to make that decision.
For the district judge, and didn't he very carefully proceed through that voir dire and explaining to the jurors exactly, and asking any of them if they had any anxiety or any worry about? I've read the transcript of his questions, and he seems to have covered everything you've mentioned as being a valid reason for another transfer. Did he not?
Yes.
Is there another question he could have asked?
It's our position that there was no other question they could have asked, because the damage.
In other words,
that
it would then be an abuse of discretion that he failed to grant the venue change.
That motion was made and denied prior to the voir dire, and the damage was already done.
But he could have granted it as the voir dire began if each of the jurors expressed some reservation, could he not?
Yes, and that did not come up because the jurors did not. And so in that sense, the court is correct. We have not raised, and I, in fact, do not have any disagreement with the way Judge Keenan handled the voir dire. I thought it was very admirable and a very sensitive case, but I do believe that there was the issue. It was a matter of law. It should have been transferred.
Can I ask you why didn't you seek a transfer within the district to Rockford? That doesn't make sense to me, because it seems one way to answer Judge Gibbons' question is, well, it was this courthouse that was the target of the plot. It was this courthouse where the trial would be held. That seems to be the most prejudicial combination here, and you eliminate that by moving to go to Rockford, which, as I understand it, you didn't do. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that.
We didn't limit our request to any, either the Western District, Western Division.
Oh, I thought it was specifically to transfer it outside of this district. And so that precluded Rockford.
Yes.
So I'm asking you why. I don't understand that, because it would have seemed that that would have eased the logistical problems, kept it within the district where the crime occurred, kept it within the state where the crime occurred.
I can't reconstruct the thought process, and I'm not saying that wouldn't have been another alternative, but I believe, for example, there are other districts that probably would be closer as far as there. It could have been heard.
Could have moved to Gary, for that matter, could you not?
House in Hammond is a courthouse that's closer than the courthouse.
But I guess I'm making the point that your motion technically was to move it outside the district.
Yes.
All right, and I'm saying one reason perhaps you should lose that is it could have been kept within the district. And so we have to look at this as if it was could have been tried in Chicago or Rockford. And if that's true, it seems to me you clearly lose. I don't see how you could win had it been tried in Rockford.
I don't know that there is authority that requires us to do that, or else we're foreclosed from raising the other issue. But if I'll defer to the court on that. But I will say this, that the purpose for the rule and the reason why it's presumptively tried in the district where it occurred is the convenience of the witnesses and all of the evidence. And as you know from the record of this case, the witnesses in this case were not in large part limited to Chicago. In fact, the main cooperating individual who testified, the defendant met him in Yazoo City, Mississippi. He had since later been transferred to another federal institution, I believe in Texas or Oklahoma. The other agents or the law enforcement witnesses were not out of Chicago in large part. So the convenience issue, the reason to transfer it closer within the district to Rockford, I think is does not apply in this case. But I understand what the court is saying, but I believe a transfer outside of the district.
I take it you wouldn't concede that Rockford would have worked?
It would have been certainly one of the other alternatives.
No,
yes.
but wouldn't you concede if it had been in Rockford, you wouldn't have this argument anymore, all other things being true?
That's true.
Okay.
If it had been
right.
In Rockford.
Right.
Why don't you move on down to the severance question and how that ties into the confrontation question? Because I think those two are more closely related,
okay,
rather than separate issues, are they not?
Yes, there are some crossover. The Rule 8 and Rule 14 issue with regard to the separate offenses. First of all, Judge Keenan ruled, based on his finding, based on the pleadings, that the evidence was inevitably in the language of Rule 8, and if I can just quote it exactly, the government has said that there's two separate theories under which the evidence that the offenses should be joined. One is that it was based on the same act or transaction, and the other is that it's connected with or constitute parts of a common scheme or plan.
And you would think, you thought, and what you attempted to get the district judge to agree to would be that it would be severed and he would try the counterfeiting charge separately from the other charges.
That's correct.
All right. Now, why were not the counterfeit charges so inexplicably intertwined with the others as to make that the basis would have to be something more than I see right now.
Our theory of defense was that this was an entrapment case. It was
right. We understand that.
It was different. The evidence with regard.
But he has to enter the entrapment defense theory with a, and we'll keep going just a little long, with a mind of free of any influence, and it was not he who began this discussion.
Our theory is that as to the counterfeiting issues, I don't believe it was the only reason it is connected to the other is because of the government's action, and they were the ones in the record in this case. It is our position that the defendant, whatever he might have been done with regard to the counterfeiting, when it was an issue of that money is for this other scheme that you have, that was the government that would bring that up. And that's why I think that it was not fair to try them both together, because we might have been able to I believe we'd made a much stronger case as to each of the defenses if they were not tried together.
Well, did you in fact succeed in getting an entrapment instruction?
We did.
Okay. Well, if the cases had been tried separately, what evidence would not have been presented in the two cases that was presented when they were tried together? And I realize you're out of time.
No.
So you could make
That's
a
right.
short answer
I'll make it
to a question that perhaps required a long one.
I'm not sure that I could articulate specific evidence, but our position is that it was unfairly prejudicial when the jury went to make their determination when to reach their verdict.
But you haven't sought to delineate evidence that would have been admissible in one trial and not the other had the two been tried separately.
That's correct. There might have been some specific things, but not in large part. A lot of the evidence would have been the same.
And I believe you reserved part of your time for rebuttal with the clerk. So
I did, and I'll if I feel I need to, I'll ask leave of this court to address anything that is raised.
Very well. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Dice. Mr. Fox?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Brandon Fox on behalf of the United States. I'm going to start with Mr. Tice's first issue, which was whether this case could have been tried in this building. And this is a standard of abuse of discretion, and that is a key standard here. And I think that probably answers the question that Your Honor had about whether this was a law of the case doctrine. I think the Seventh Circuit, and to be fair to the defendant, I don't think this is a law of the case situation, because the Seventh Circuit just limited itself to whether they should have entered a mandamus to have Judge Bucklow recuse herself. They didn't go beyond the scope.
Sentence says that to hear any further proceedings instituted by Nettles in this court is the way it ends. And I think you would agree that the mandamus petition had both arguments in front of it, the recusal and the transfer.
And my reading, Your Honor, is, and obviously if you disagree with me, we win, so I'm not going to fight this too much. But
you better take the life raft when it's thrown to you.
Well, no.
But the Seventh Circuit, because the issue was whether they should recuse themselves as well, I believe probably just wanted to decide as discreet of an issue as possible and then send it back down and allow another district court judge to handle the proceedings and allow another appellate court panel to decide anything else. So, again, to be fair to the defense, that's my reading of it, and we've never pushed that issue because of it. So part of this is I'm explaining to you why we never pushed the law of the case.
I'm curious. What was the go ahead.
All
right, Jeff, you finish, and then Jeff.
Well, I'm just curious. I couldn't understand the position you took. You seem to think this was just all something that would be worked out through voir dire, and I'm just a little surprised the government just didn't take what seems like a common sense position, particularly after the recusal ruling, that if someone threatens to bomb the federal courthouse, we don't hold the trial in that federal courthouse. It wouldn't have a big impact. Happily, this doesn't happen very often, and Rockford's not far away. I couldn't understand the government's position on this point.
I want to raise three issues with that. First of all, this was never a relief sought by the defense. So this was never before the district court, whether it should be transferred to Rockford. So the government never took a position. It would be an intra-district transfer, and that was never on the table. So that's the first thing that I want to raise with that. And that, of course, is a waiver now at this point because the defense...
But there are other districts within Illinois, right?
So yes, of course.
Okay. So you could have gone wherever that is, Springfield. I don't know where it would be.
Springfield would be one, and the southern districts around Carbondale. But the second issue here is the case law tells us that this is appropriately decided that the voir dire process, that the courts can then determine whether there is
That's what I don't quite see. I don't see how the voir dire works here, because voir dire works if it's about knowledge of the case, publicity. I don't know how someone can tell you what level of anxiety they'll have about a trial when they haven't heard all of the evidence. It's one thing to talk about it before trial. It's another to sit through 7 days of evidence or 5 days. This was the building. This is what he was scoping out. This is what would have happened. I don't know. It just seems like something no one could know
before
trial.
And in some ways, the fact that this building is still standing, it shows that there was a little bit of prejudice that would have been eliminated. Some people, let's say that we heard this in Springfield, Illinois.
Well, of course, you can't have the trial in a building that doesn't exist, so that's not really...
Or across the building, for example, the McVeigh case would have been tried in a separate building, but they found that that should be transferred to another district because of the inherent prejudice. Here, if this was tried somewhere else, let's say a different state or a different district, whatever it would have been, there may have been some jurors wondering what happened to that building. And again, the fact that it was tried here, this building's still standing, and I think the evidence was very clear that there was no likelihood that this crime would have been carried out and that there were going to be any victims of the crime, because the FBI was involved in every step of the process with Mr. Nettles. And the jury probably would have had some assurances that this type of crime could not be carried out as a result.
Judge Gibbons, you had a question.
Well, I was going to go back to something that Judge Sutton was asking you about. When we started this line of questioning about law of the case, I started scrambling for the Seventh Circuit opinion, and I apparently don't have it out here with me. Can you refresh my memory as to exactly what Judge Posner says?
And this is, the language is not clear whether he's going to be addressing, okay, you're reading it now, I'll give you a minute.
Okay. I've read it. I don't think I have a question.
Keep going.
Okay. If you look at, and I think,
why didn't they, let me ask you this question while you're in that same realm. I mean, have you found another case or any case that would say that the action of a district judge after you've made a Rule 21 motion, 21A motion, the rule itself is fairly clear. The review of that is by abuse of discretion, is it not? And that's the case of this circuit, if I believe.
That's correct.
Mistaken.
And right, that's correct. It's abuse of discretion. And in the Constitution, it talks about the prejudice, and in the rules of criminal procedure, it talks about how the prejudice has to be so great to eliminate any possibility, basically, that the case could have been tried fairly and impartially here. And again, if you look at the veneer, and nobody basically had heard of this case, one person thought that they had, and that person was struck, the veneer was fair and impartial, and you couldn't really have asked for a more impartial and fair veneer.
Did they make a motion at the conclusion of the discussion with the jurors that it be transferred again?
No, Your Honor.
So they have to waive that second. That has to be classified as a waiver then, does it, as to the second? Because you can, in some of these districts, I remember not here, but I remember a case from, my mind is drifting a bit, but I do remember a district judge who was all the way to seat the jury and then agreed, and I believe it was at one point it was in Pennsylvania, but I think it was moved then from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh because there was, at least in the judge's mind, but there was no motion here to move at the end of that, was there?
There was not, and I...
And until the jury is sworn, there's no jeopardy attached, so that jury pool can be dismissed and a new pool chosen at another location if he had made that motion at the end of the voir dire.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I have to be frank with you. I've not done the research to find out whether that'd be forfeiture, waiver, or none of the above.
I couldn't find it either, so I'm just telling you. I'm just saying, that's why I'm asking you.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to that. I do know that this was a fair and impartial jury based on the voir dire questioning, and the defense, I think, pointed out today that they had no other questions for the judge to ask in the voir dire process. And I think that's a key admission, as in the fact that they did not move to strike one person for cause because they were concerned that they were biased. And again, I cited to a case that shows, it's a Supreme Court case, that shows that without that strike, it shows that the defense conceivably thought that the jury was unbiased.
Now, moving on to the other two issues, does the Tolliver case basically foreclose any discussion of the confrontation, in your view?
I believe so, Your Honor, and that's why I cited it in the 28J letter.
And so the other issue that he has is the motion to try him separately with the counterfeiting charge at one trial and then the ultimate attempt as the second trial. Now, why was he foreclosed and why was that not prejudicial error?
Two issues here. First was the joinder proper, and I think joinder was proper when you consider that there was a common scheme or plan here. You know, it was the common object of the defendant to blow up this building, to destroy this building, both in the counterfeiting offenses, which were going to fund his plot, and also in the charges of counts 1 of 2 that he was attempting to destroy this building, obviously. So the evidence overlapped incredibly. If you looked at each individual tape that we introduced as evidence, those tapes had discussions of both counterfeiting and also the attempt to purchase fertilizer or destroy this building. So it would have been almost impossible to parse out in each individual tape information that related to the counterfeiting offenses and information that related to the attempt to destroy this building
Well, then that ties back into his entrapment defense on the misjoinder. I mean, he did get the, Judge Gibbons asked the defense counsel, he did get that entrapment instruction.
He did, and I think key to entrapment is the intent of somebody, and obviously intent and motive go hand in hand, and his motive was, you know, to destroy this building, the object of his offense. So I think that both his counterfeiting and his attempts to purchase fertilizer and blow up this building would have come into play at both if these trials were separate. And I do want to point out that the defense has talked about that he could have testified had this been severed, and there's not been one indication of what that testimony would have been had
he
testified.
Could have been cross-examined if he were separate. If the counts were separated at the two trials, which does not make judicial sense, but if they were, and he testified at the counterfeiting trial, could he not be cross-examined on the same point that he brought up at the whole trial, which was that he'd been convicted of counterfeiting once before?
That would have come in at both trials.
And that would have come in at trial as a prior conviction, would it not?
Agreed. And that also would have come in, even if the judge would have found that would have been prejudicial on one hand, just if it went to strictly towards his credibility. It also was his motive in this case. He said that his motive to want to destroy the Dirksen Federal Building was his prior counterfeiting offense, and he wasn't happy with the sentence that he received by Judge Zagel. So that would have come in both in counterfeiting and also in the offenses about this building.
I assume that the defendant only argued that entrapment applied to the attempt.
He argued for both, and he got an instruction for both.
For both, he got an instruction for counterfeiting.
Argued against it on both sets of counts, and the judge allowed it for both sets of counts.
So, and Judge Keenan instructed the jury that the counterfeiting convictions were admissible, of course, not for credibility, because the defendant didn't testify, but only for purposes of showing his motive to commit the attempt. Was a specific instruction given about predisposition with respect to the counterfeiting?
Yes, and he said, and I'm going to quote what he said, he told the jury that it would be, quote, grossly improper to find the defendant guilty because he had committed a previous counterfeiting offense. So, yes, he did limit the jury and the case.
But he didn't affirmatively say you may consider the prior counterfeiting conviction as evidence of predisposition. He couched it in the negative, correct?
No, actually, it was two separate times. This was prior when he was talking about the conviction and the fact that when we introduced the evidence of his conviction, the judge instructed the jury that it would be grossly improper to consider it in terms of whether he had committed these
offenses. And that's really
the
portion of the instruction that's raised before us in the briefs. Whatever he said in the entrapment instruction, we really don't have argued.
Okay, and just so you know, well, I did cite to it in my brief, but what he did say is he's quoted Rule 404B and added predisposition as well to the other aspects of 404B. So he did instruct them on 404B.
So he delineated all the possible bases for considering and excluded the improper basis for admission of the evidence as well.
But predisposition, because this was an entrapment case, was a proper...
Oh, I understand
yes.
that.
Okay.
The improper basis being credibility or, because he did it before, he did it again.
Right, and the reason why I'm being a little bit careful here, you're right on credibility. He did not mean that. He did not state that. That this went to his credibility, obviously, because the defendant didn't testify. But also, the reason why I'm being careful is predisposition, and because he did this before, he may do it again. Those are very close concepts.
Oh, they are, but they're distinct.
Correct. The other thing that I want to point out with the third issue before I sit down is, and this relates to the tapes, is that the defendant was found not guilty of the counts that really went toward that tape. So there would be a harmless error analysis even if Tolliver did not apply.
Yeah. Right. Now, Judge Sutton had a question he wanted to ask you, I think, on a point.
Yeah, just two follow-up questions. I'm sorry to take you back to the first issue. I'm still struggling with a little bit. Am I right in reading the case law that there's not a single case out there where the attempt or the successful plot was directed at the same courthouse where the criminal trial was held? I mean, all your cases are about where the crime occurred in the building, but which is quite distinct, and I think is exactly what made the judges all recuse themselves. But there isn't a case that involves that, is there?
I've not been able to find one, and I always try to be careful again here about whether it exists and whether I was able to find one.
I have the same problem in writing opinions.
Okay.
But that takes me to the next question. You know, you look back at this Seventh Circuit order, you know, clearly the target was not the non-resident judges, right? I mean, they're here 32 days of the year. The target was the resident judges, both Court of Appeals and District Court judges. But yet the non-resident judges recused themselves, even though I wouldn't call them similarly situated to jurors. They're here 32 days a year. A juror might be here once every 5 years.
There was a case, U.S. v. Matthew Hale. It involved a white supremacist who attempted to murder a federal judge in this building, and the Seventh Circuit recused all district court judges because they were considered to be brethren of this judge. There might be the appearance of prejudice. We thought that was interesting as well, that the Seventh Circuit in this case did not say, okay, Judge Evans, you still can decide this case because you're only here a few days out of the year.
But Judge Sykes wasn't even a judge for almost the whole plot. I think she may have heard a case the day before he was arrested.
And again, I don't know how to read that opinion in terms of why they didn't allow Judge Sykes
to
hear
this on
appeal.
Well, I'll tell you, the problem they have this sweeping across the board. There's so much risk here, and then you have to say yourself, okay, we're supposed to implement this law, and it leads you to have some sympathy for defendant's argument.
And let me say two things here. First of all, again, the brethren position with respect to Matthew Hale, I think it is applicable here. While you may not want to have Judge Sykes hearing this case where she understands that it could have been the person sitting next to her that would have been killed had this plot gone through. The second thing is the evidence was fairly clear that defendant intended to bomb this building within a month to a month and a half after receiving the fertilizer. And this jury heard the case well over a year after the arrest had occurred. So they were outside of the window where he was attempting to destroy this building.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Wong.
We obviously ask that you affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Teich, would you like to use your 2 minutes? Or more?
Just very briefly, because I didn't have much of an opportunity, the court, I understand the court's question with regard to the third issue, and if the court has, I would suggest that this might be a little different here with regard to the nature of the statements that are made by the law enforcement individual here. Because it was an entrapment case and there was the nature of the those conversations might have a little bit more significance.
Well, if we found entrapment as a matter of law, then you can distinguish Tolliver. But if we don't find it as a matter of law, aren't we bound by Tolliver?
Certainly.
I mean, at least we recognize that one panel does not overrule another panel, even if they disagree with it. So we're pretty much, you know, we might argue about the exact interpretation in Tolliver, but we're still bound by that decision, aren't we, unless we do find complete entrapment.
I'm suggesting, I agree with the court, you're bound by the decision. I just didn't want to limit myself to distinctions.
I see. All right.
with regard to that.
I think I understand, and I took most of your 2 minutes, so go ahead and talk a little more.
That's fine, Judge. I believe the government's position that they've articulated here today, I don't agree with the idea that if we had made a motion to transfer it to another district within the state of Illinois, we didn't actually discuss other districts. The Western Division in Rockford is another division of the Northern District of Illinois.
Right, which is why it's important that you technically moved for transfer outside the district and chose not to seek relief within the district, which would have solved the only problem I can see with trying the case here.
Other than the ones that, I understand what the court's saying. I'm just saying that our position is that that doesn't solve the problem, or it doesn't.
Why not? I mean, you have two options, A and B, and you don't choose B, which everyone agrees solves the problem. You only say, I want A and B. And so you gave up your chance at the solution.
I'm not saying that it wouldn't have solved the problem. And if I said that, I That's not my intent to say that. What I'm saying is it doesn't, by not doing it, we're not foreclosed from arguing that the other solution would have been a better solution, which is what our position is.
I.e. Springfield's better than Rockford.
Springfield or Hammond or Milwaukee or wherever they would have thought it appropriate. And again,
Even going back to the McVeigh case, I mean, which you cited in your brief, which I think is not quite the same situation, but at least you cited that for that purpose. They made sure that it stayed within the Tenth Circuit, but sent it to the nearest and largest available unit of that circuit. And if you'd made a specific motion maybe to move it to Milwaukee, that would have solved that problem. It's just that you wanted to change your venue, but you didn't give any guidance to the court. That's the weakness of that argument, is there not? Is it not?
I understand what you're saying. I just don't think that those kind of ministerial or administrative issues are the defense's purview. I think our motion was to take it out of here and let the court decide what the appropriate
place. Sometimes we can't decide that either. So that's why you better give us some help once in a while.
Is there anything in the record that shows the U.S. would have opposed a move to Rockford?
No.
They just opposed the venue change.
Right.
But if there had been an alternative, we don't know what would have happened.
Well, if we had suggested a specific alternative, I don't believe that suggesting a specific location for the trial would have been the deciding factor for the court. But it
might have been.
I mean, Judge Keenan certainly would have been aware of the options. Those kind of, again, administrative issues, I think, are more appropriate for the courts to determine than the defense.
Go ahead, Judge.
And it might have even looked, like we were forum shopping if we were to say we'd like to hear this in New Orleans or what.
One quick question. Rockford is a separate division or not?
The separate division of the Northern District.
Okay.
It's like Jackson.
Yeah, well, it could be just another place
right.
of holding court as
no.
opposed to a division. I wanted to know if it's a division.
It's a separate division, is it not?
That's
referred to
said.
As the Western Division of the Northern District.
That's right.
It means
no,
the jurors right. would have come from a separate
fine.
Division
incorrect.
As opposed to...
From the Chicago
yeah.
Division. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be submitted. You may adjourn the court.